I'm Joseph O'Connell. I'm visiting here for this term only from the University of Toronto, from which I have retired. And for this term only, also visiting is Professor Ruby Sine, who's the chair of sociology in Jadavpur University in Calcutta. We're both here courtesy of the Shivdasani Foundation or Fellowship Program for this term only. And Professor Ruby Sine will be sharing the session with me, though since it was initially my task to do this, I unfortunately for you get the lion's share of the time. But Ruby will be making a report after I make the report that follows the general introduction. So, any questions, comments, or urgent matters before we jump into this subject? The subject is something that Professor Ruby Sine and I are both very much involved in. She much more intensively, but only recently, for the last 3 years or so, as you'll hear from her, has been very much a key figure in launching the academic study of religion, especially sociological study of religion, in one of the finer universities of India, Jadavpur, and she'll be telling you about that. I, in my leisurely retirement for the last 10 years or so, have been spending a couple of months at Dhaka University in Bangladesh, which is the only university, public university in Bangladesh that I know of, that has, in fact, a whole department of world religions and culture. And I'm on the edge of that project. She is very much at the heart of hers. And in the last couple of years, I've had occasion to speak in several settings regarding this interesting phenomenon that there is a lot of religion in the life of people in the South Asian countries, and hardly any formal academic study of religion as such in the universities in those countries. So that's where we are. What do we make of this interesting paradox or disparity of things? So let's go ahead. For various reasons, some quite obvious, some not so, there has been an extreme reluctance of scholars and universities across South Asia to address explicitly and with adequate sensitivity and depth religious phenomena as such, or the religious aspects of psychological, cultural, social, or political life. For this reason, I would like to address what seems to me to be a troubling anomaly, namely the striking disparity between the prominence of religion, religious factors in the personal and collective life of so much of the population of South Asia, and the extreme rarity of study, teaching, research on religion in the universities of the same countries. This anomalous disparity has recently become the subject of concern to a number of scholars within South Asia, as well as to some of us elsewhere who focus our own scholarship on religion in South Asia. So after commenting on the disparity generally and its probable causes, I'll illustrate some of the points with reference to the relatively new Department of World Religions and Culture in the University of Dhaka, Bangladesh, where, as I said, for the last 10 years or so, I've spent a couple of months each winter. Also, I'll comment briefly on the older Department of Philosophy and Religion in Vishwabharati, Rabindranath Tagore's university, and with which I have some acquaintance. And we're especially fortunate today to have with us the chair of the Department of Sociology at Jadavpur, Professor Ruby Sine. She's recently launched a Center for Religion and Society within her department, and in collaboration with Professors O.K. Sander and Ferdinando Sardella and other scholars in Sweden, an interesting India-Sweden cooperative venture. And she'll be reporting on that later in this session. So back to the big disparity. There's a striking disparity between the richness of human phenomena in South Asia and the paucity of department centers or even programs for academic as distinguished from confessional study of religion in South Asian universities. By academic, I mean impartial inquiry based on evidence that any competent observer can recognize, inquiry that is in principle comparative but in a descriptive, not in an evaluative ranking kind of sense. There are, of course, Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, Sikh, Christian institutions in South Asia where confessional, that is, from the perspective of a particular faith commitment, where confessional study and practice of a favored religious way of life is indeed fostered. There is also considerable study and research of high quality on particular religious texts, movements, institutions, and systems of thought conducted in certain departments and programs of history, philosophy, and the social sciences in some leading South Asian universities, especially in India. But in such discipline-specific contexts, the specifically, distinctively religious aspects of subjects of study or research are at risk of being marginalized theoretically or being treated dismissively in some cases. And even when commendable treatment of religion is done in such discipline-specific contexts, the basic question still presents itself with some force. Why is there so very little academic study of religion as such on a comparative pluralist basis when other disciplines developed in the West have been successfully transplanted in South Asian academic soil? So, some partial explanations for this. Number one, the Western origin of academic religious studies. Among other factors suggested as accounting for the virtual absence of religious studies in South Asian universities is that it first took shape as a distinct field of scholarship in Europe in relation to particular late 19th century European religio-cultural and political circumstances. True enough, this kind of study and research, like others, did have its origin in a particular European historical context. But that need not prevent a type of scholarly or intellectual endeavor from transplanting itself and flourishing in South Asia or elsewhere, as have English language, law, political institutions, ideologies, scientific theories, and diverse academic disciplines that arose in Europe within their particular historical circumstances. Why not academic study of religion? Obviously, there is no dominant Christian theological institutional foil against which academic religious studies might have emerged and defined itself in India, Bangladesh, or elsewhere in South Asia, as was the case in 19th century Europe. But it is not difficult to identify Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, and Sikh religious establishments in different parts of South Asia that in terms of their interests, power, and influence on the lives of individuals are analogous to the Christian religious establishment in Europe. And there are, and long have been, diverse intellectual and academic traditions of critical thought in South Asia, again, especially in India, as none other than Amartya Sen has frequently pointed out, the argumentative Indians. These latter, in some instances, have been and still are in severe tension with one or another religious establishment. We might have expected there to have developed, especially in India, some homegrown version or versions of intellectually critical, non-confessional study and research in religion. The precise forms of such non-confessional religious study as might have emerged, or may yet emerge in India or elsewhere in South Asia, need not, of course, be clones of any Western analog or predecessor. So, why has academic study of religion not emerged despite the tensions between religio-cultural establishments and the traditions of intellectually free and critical thought in the region? Well, another suggestion? Welcome to Professor Mundakranta Bose from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. Very nice of you to come. You just missed the point where I commented that there are such things as conflicts between academic scholars of religion and religious establishments, such as the Sikh establishment. Your university has experienced that. We have been on the front lines of that one, and others are now doing it with the Hindus, so this is an interesting phenomenon. Anyway, back to the next partial reason, perhaps, for the lack of religious studies as such in South Asia. So another line of response, and it's related to it, is to point to the Euro-American cultural peculiarity, or particularity rather, the cultural particularity of much of current religious studies scholarship, especially the literature and the mentality behind scholarly literature. the fact that the vast bulk of scholarly publications in the field so far are in English or European languages obviously presents a major conceptual challenge, even for students and teachers in elite universities of India and elsewhere who are capable of reading the available literature. Much could be said and should be said about how to make academic study of religion a more authentic, indigenized enterprise in non-Western cultures. And let me here offer one hypothetical example, what I call revamping the theory and method course as pertinent to India. This little example. The revamping should first off acknowledge clearly the extent and in what respects the contributions of early and many later architects of this field of study, how much they were restricted in their relevance to their own time and place in European American history. Those aspects that are no longer of relevance in one or another South Asian context, and South Asian contexts themselves can be quite diverse, may well be omitted or at least reduced to historical footnotes. Those aspects of method and theory that, despite their Western origins, still do have relevance in South Asia should be distinguished, further developed, and applied imaginatively and critically in South Asian contexts. In addition, there should be added to the method and theory course selective critical introductions to salient past and present South Asian examples of describing, analyzing, comparing, and criticizing various ways of being religious. These could include Brahmanic, Buddhist, China, Muslim, Parsi, Indian Christian, secular, and any other pertinent examples. Some examples might include whole systems of interpretation shared by a whole school of thought. Others could be the ideas and works of notable individuals. The examples selected for scrutiny may not be strictly academic in the current professional sense, but they should be intelligent, systematic, informed, and in some respects, rigorously critical accounts of different ways and aspects of being religious that have been developed within the area. As more scholars of South Asian cultural heritage enter and rise in the field of academic religious studies, and as more universities in India bite the bullet, shall we say, by pioneering religious studies, this sort of intellectually rigorous indigenizing of the field may be expected to progress. But as of now, there's a long way to go. Another suggestion or two. Novelty and educational resources or the lack thereof. Another partial explanation for the scarcity of religious studies in South Asian universities is that it is a relatively novel field of study, even in many parts of North America and Europe, too recent to have created a demand for it. Accordingly, there is scarcity of suitable textbooks and other educational resources, to say nothing of a shortage of trained teachers. That there are extreme shortages of suitable instructional materials and teachers is painfully obvious, and such shortages pose huge obstacles, especially for students whose English is weak or non-existent. If academic study of religion is to flourish in the various linguistic regions of South Asia and not be exclusively in the hands of those of the elite universities, a broad spectrum of South Asian language resources for teaching and studying about religion need to be produced and brought into play, and sooner rather than later, especially the case in the Bengal region, at least Shantiniketan and Dhaka. I'm not sure about Jodhpur. Moreover, one dominant language, currently English, but it could become Chinese or Arabic or something else sometime, one dominant language is virtually the sole linguistic medium of global-level communication in the field of academic study of religion. As a result, it seems to me, insight into human religious thinking, feeling, and motivation at subtle and deep levels tends to be constrained to be arbitrarily biased toward that language, its dominant mental cultural patterns and political economic interests tends to be biased in those directions. Multilingual communication, even, especially at advanced levels of scholarship, would, I suggest, facilitate a more enriched understanding and experience of human religiousness. Anyway, novelty of content, lack of resources and restrictions due to language, however, have not prevented other novel types of study and research from being espoused rapidly by South Asian academics and related educational resources developed, such as in women's studies, and now environmental studies. So the fundamental reasons must lie elsewhere. My suggestion is that two major factors are sheer inertia of pre-independence educational patterns and severe tensions between religio-communal and secularist establishments. A third major factor, one that I'll not elaborate in today's talk, but is certainly a real one, is lack of employment opportunities and other economic advantages for any graduates in religion. So let's look at this precedent of colonial British educational policy. One of the most basic historical reasons for retarded development of religious studies in South Asian universities, I think, is British colonial educational policy. The pattern-setting universities and curricula established in 1857 did not include religious studies. This conformed to the basic British policy of keeping hands off sensitive religio-cultural matters. Moreover, obviously, these premier universities were established before the new comparative religion, or science of religion, as it was called, was even developed in Europe. But a precedent was set. The precedent was set, and like so many other precedents set in colonial British India, which embraced present-day Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and smaller South Asian states, as well as India, has been followed long after independence in 1947. But this answer avoids the nagging question. Why, with the dawning of independence in 1947 and the opportunities to express long-suppressed cultural aspirations in education, should the exclusion of religious studies from academia be so rigidly maintained in South Asian countries, in which religion was and still is so salient an aspect of life? Another answer to the why question. Severe tensions between religio-political communal interests and secular interests in South Asia. That factor is the persistent severe tension, even erupting in violence at times, between politically mobilized religio-cultural communalist interest on the one hand and politically mobilized elite secular interest on the other. Consider India. In India, right from independence in 1947, the secularist elite, relatively small in number but strongly committed and influentially positioned inside and outside the Congress Party, the Government of India, and higher education, systematically discouraged expressions of interest in religion in the public arena, including public education. In more recent decades, a powerful religio-political Hindu communal resurgence has intensified secularist concern lest initiatives for religion and education provide opportunities for Hindu communalism to exploit. For their part, the advocates of Hindutva or Hinduness or Hindu Jagaran, the Hindu Awakening, have exhibited hostility towards rather than commitment to even-handed treatment of non-Hindus or to empathetic study of their non-Hindu religious traditions. Indian Muslims, for the most part, for most of the period since independence, have tended to be defensive and inward-looking. With the exception of a minority of secular intellectuals, they have remained quiet, while more conservative ulama of the Deoband school or the fundamentalist Jamaat-e-Islami would speak for them, this too not being very conducive to fostering a milieu supportive of comparative academic study of religion. Consider Pakistan. The founding father of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, himself a dedicated, decidedly secular individual, died a year after 1947 independence, and with him died his ideal of Pakistan as a tolerant, pluralist, constitutionally secular, Muslim-majority state. While the more secular elites have so far resisted turning Pakistan into a contemporary instance of a Sharia-bound Islamic state, they have not been able to prevent more traditionalist and fundamentalist Muslims from exerting more and more influence over state and society. With virtually all Hindus and Sikhs having fled from West Pakistan in 1947, and the few remaining Christians there ever at risk, one of their leaders was assassinated a month or two ago, with unstable governments, civilian governments alternating with unpopular military regimes, with Ahmadiyya Muslims being massacred by fundamentalist Muslims, West Pakistan clearly has not provided an environment favorable to comparative academic study of religion. Consider Bangladesh. East Pakistan, however, in East Pakistan, the balance between Islamist and secularist has been more even. And apart from the extremely bitter 1971 struggle for Bangladeshi independence, the tensions between them generally have been less virulent than in West Pakistan. Most Hindus in what became East Pakistan initially chose to stay there in 1947, and Hindus, reinforced by small but vocal Christian and Buddhist communities, continue to form a not insignificant, though shrinking, minority of the population, from about 20% in 47 to about 10% at the present. The bulk of East Pakistani, now Bangladeshi, population, moreover, while self-consciously Muslim, is neither politically Islamist nor ideologically secularist. There are, however, strongly committed and well-organized Islamist organizations which run the gamut from the politically sophisticated Jamaat-e-Islami Bangladesh political party through lesser Islamist parties and a medley of traditionalist orthodox groups to clandestine terrorist networks. On the other hand, there is also an articulate body of committed secularists, themselves mostly Muslims, dispersed among small leftist political parties, the currently ruling Awami League, NGOs, academia, journalism, literary and artistic circles. The two main political parties tend one toward Islamist and the other toward secularist orientations, but each resents a much wider range of interests, and neither is well-disciplined or consistent. The public universities, unfortunately, are severely politicized, and in consequence, their quality has been degraded, each exhibiting a comparable range of partisan orientations among its staff. Yet, it was within this milieu that there emerged a little over 10 years ago a Department of World Religions, currently World Religions and Culture, in the University of Dhaka, the premier public university in Bangladesh. The emergence of the Department of World Religions and Culture in the University of Dhaka was something of an anomaly. There was no precedent for it in Bangladesh, nor in erstwhile East Pakistan. Like its older Indian counterparts, DU, or Dhaka University, was founded in colonial India following British patterns of academia and without any department for comparative academic study of religion. Launching the new department was due overwhelmingly to the unstinting conviction, persistence, and personal diplomacy of one professor of philosophy, Qazi Nurul Islam, plus the support of some like-minded colleagues within the Faculty of Arts of the Dhaka University. After a decade-long campaign, the university authorities agreed to establish a minuscule Department of Comparative Religion in the Faculty of Arts. But that nomenclature brought out opposition from two quarters, those Muslims who insisted that Islam was incomparable, and those Hindus who feared negative comparison when compared, their religion was to be compared by the Muslim scholars who would dominate the department. Nonetheless, with its name tactically changed to World Religions, since modified to World Religions and Culture, the new department was launched in 1999, initially to teach MA students. After 2 years, an MPhil program was added, and a few years later, a four-year honors, that is, undergraduate program. The department is authorized to offer the PhD, though till now perhaps only one candidate may have completed a doctoral program. Recently, a Center for Interfaith and Intercultural Dialogue was established in conjunction with the department, again thanks to the efforts of Professor Qazi Nurul Islam. In formal and quantitative terms, the Department of World Religions and Culture in Dhaka University has shown remarkable growth in the space of a decade, but in practice, its hasty expansion and future development remain somewhat problematic. Departmental ethos. Departmental ethos. Thanks to the tireless exhortations of the founding chairman, there is a widespread conviction among students and staff, a departmental ethos, if you will, that genuine religion is humane and tolerant and an influence for peace, and that intolerance and violence in the name of religion are in fact falsifications of religion, whether it be Muslim, Hindu, Christian, or religion of whatever other sort. Interfaith dialogue is integral to the vision of world religions of the department's founder, as reflected in the department's mission statement, which I'll read a bit of. Though all religions of the world teach love, preach sympathy for others, and encourage man to exercise utmost self-restraint, and have most profoundly been a source of inspiration for the highest good of mankind, The world today is torn by conflicts, enmity, and religious hatred. In this predicament, a peaceful society is impossible unless people belonging to different faiths understand each other better. Closed quote. Professor Qazi Nur al-Islam's zealous advocacy of interfaith dialogue for mutual respect and peace provides a certain elan, a sense of purpose to the department. In the process, it tends to instill a departmental view or ethos based on axioms that true religion is religion for peace, and that all genuine religion is based on similar benign human principles. These are edifying views, no doubt, but there may be a downside if they are assumed uncritically and without qualifications. There is a risk that students and even teachers' perceptiveness of the complexities and ambiguities in religion may be dulled or inhibited. There may develop a tendency to rely on platitudes rather than reasoned, evidence-based arguments and conclusions, to confuse research with edification and advocacy. I do not mean to say that dialogue necessarily undermines religious academic study and research on religion. It need not. Indeed, at its best, participation in dialogue implies listening to and speaking with others respectfully and attentively. This should enhance one's sensitivity to the religious meaning, feelings, and intentions of others, a sensitivity that is fundamental to scholarship on religion, as the late Wilfred Cantwell Smith has so forcefully contended. But to negotiate an optimal marriage of dialogue and scholarship is not without its challenges. Back really to the main thrust of the scope and warrant for religious studies provided by secularist and communalist fundamentalist tension. The success thus far of the Dhaka University initiative would seem to illustrate that religio-political communalist, in this case Islamist, versus secular tension need not necessarily prevent academic study of religion, provided neither side is overwhelmingly dominant and provided the tension has not boiled over into violence or intimidation. Though it comes very close to that, even in Dhaka at times. On the contrary, such tension may be appealed to as justifying the need for comparative academic study of religion. The Dhaka initiative may also illustrate how such tension can influence the way study of religion is conceived, including its proffered partnership with dialogue. In Bangladesh, sporadic harassment, with relative impunity, unfortunately, of non-Muslims and certain categories of Muslims, Ahmadiyya's traditional peers and their mazar institutions, communally marginal Baal minstrels, by unscrupulous land grabbers, or by groups seeking extra-legally to impose fundamentalist Islamic norms, is frequent and flagrant enough to be pointed to as warranting both world religion study and interfaith dialogue as antidotes. It can be claimed with some plausibility that genuine study of religion, one's own as well as others, will show how false are the claims of the intolerant and often violent voices of those who allegedly exploit, falsify, and debase Islam, or in principle any other mode of religion, for material, political, or fanatic religious gain. There is, moreover, in Bangladesh, a widespread unease over the harsh polarization of secularist and Islamic polemics against each other. Thus, the claim that peace lies at the heart of all religion, Islamic no less than others, if only we understand religion aright, may ring true to many God-fearing Muslims and other men and women of religious faith. That is, the vast majority of the Bangladeshi population. This, too, may contribute to a congenial milieu for world religion scholarship as well as for interfaith dialogue. With most Bangladeshis being of neither strongly fundamentalist nor strongly secularist mentality, there is potentially broad support for studying religion in a calm, unbiased way that aspires to disclose and promote more humane and authentic peaceful expressions of religious faith. World religions teaching, as practiced currently in Dhaka University, does not single out the Islamic tradition as uniquely prone to intolerance, but rather subjects any religious tradition to similar assessment, guided by the same harmonizing assumption that in its authentic form, religious faith anywhere is humane and peace-loving. This ironic and respectful line of argument serves to deflect or disarm opposition from Muslim and other staunchly religious potential critics. By much the same argument, secular-minded potential critics of religious studies may be reassured that an even-handed, empathetic approach to the plurality of religious traditions will undermine the appeal of the intolerance and fanaticism that they loathe and fear. The Bangladeshi experience of world religions and culture in Dhaka University may suggest that in religiously plural, but still Hindu-majority, India, where secularist and Hindu communalist interests are now more evenly balanced than before, there may be increasing scope and warrant for developing world religion scholarship, that is, comparative academic study of religion, for reasons analogous to those in Muslim-majority Bangladesh. Vishwa Bharati, its Department of Philosophy and Religion, and the proposed Institute for Research and Religion Society. Vishwa Bharati, the sui generis educational institution, founded and for 20 years or so guided by poet-educationist Rabindranath Tagore, has from its outset in 1920, had from its outset in 1921, a commitment to being a venue where persons of diverse racial, national, cultural, and religious orientations could assemble in a respectful milieu, as, in Tagore's words, a great meeting of friends, to address profound issues facing humanity. Tagore aimed, in his own words, I quote, to provide at Shantiniketan, a center of culture, where research into the study of the religion, literature, history, science, and art of Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, Zoroastrian, Islamic, Sikh, Christian, and other civilizations may be pursued, along with the culture of the West. Close quote. Although there was established, or there were established in Tagore's lifetime, 1861 to 41, several chairs and faculties to support study and research in some of the areas mentioned above, there was no department or program for religious studies as such. This is not altogether surprising in view of Tagore's sustained critique of organized religious institutions and competing religio-cultural traditions. But by the 1950s, there was a Department of Philosophy and Religion in Vishwa Bharati. It was likely the first department in an Indian university, or a public one anyway, explicitly dedicated to religious studies, though in partnership with a much senior partner, philosophy. The religion partner has always been secondary to philosophy and, till recently, has had relatively little impact within or beyond Vishwa Bharati. It did, however, under the energetic chairmanship of Professor Asha Mukherjee, herself a philosophy scholar, hold a very promising three-day workshop on academic study of religion in India in February 2008. It seemed then that Rabindranath's aspiration for a great meeting of friends was about to be realized at Vishwa Bharati in the context of religious studies. But, sadly, when a new chair was appointed to succeed Professor Mukherjee, disgruntled members of the department began a series of court challenges that have damaged departmental morale and undermined its potential role as a catalyst for development of study and research on religion in India. Not all is lost, however. As a proposal, a very recent proposal, to establish a pan-Vishwa Bharati institute or program for research on religion and society has been approved by a pro-vice chancellor's committee and the university's academic council. The precise shape and directorship of this new pan-university entity are not yet determined, but we may remain hopeful that in this sesquicentennial year of Rabindranath's birth, his Vishwa Bharati will at last respond to the founder's call to be a great meeting of friends for exploring the nexus of religion and society. Professor Asha Mukherjee herself is in Sweden as we speak, following a conference organized by Professors R.K. Sander and Ferdinando Sardella. They are charting current and forthcoming collaboration between Swedish scholars and institutions on the one hand, and certain South Asian scholars and their institutions on the other, including Vishwa Bharati and, very prominently, Jadavpur. We may wish them well. This morning I received an email from Professor Sardella summarizing a number of the initiatives that are being taken from Sweden in collaboration with several institutions in India. We might mention those a bit later. We come now to Jadavpur University's new Center for Study of Society and Religion within the Department of Sociology. So let me now invite Professor Ruby Sine, Chair of the Department of Sociology in Jadavpur University, to tell us about the very promising new Center for Study of Society and Religion that she is bringing into existence in her department and university in collaboration with her Swedish partners. So, as they say on the Lily, the news. Over to you, Ruby.
Thank you.
All you see is Ruby's head talking here. Terrible. We have the whole. We got the full Monty, the full Ruby. So carry on.
Thank you, Professor Cornell, for giving me this chance, and I'm very much glad to present here something. And before saying something about the sociology of religion, I want to, I would like to say something about my university also. Then I'll go to sociology of religion and other things. Jadavpur University, you know very well, has a long and distinguished heritage. The years 1905 to 6 are memorable in the history of Bengal and indeed in that of India. The attempt by the government to partition Bengal led to a countrywide agitation and an intense nationalist movement, which, though political at the outset, had important economic and cultural implications. The economic aspect of the movement found expression in the production and use of Swadeshi goods. The cultural impact was felt in the regeneration of Indian art and music, but most of all in a reaction against the prevalent system of education and the devising of an alternative plan entirely on national lines and directed towards serving the national interest. It was in this way that the National Council of Education Bengal was started in 1906 to impart education, literary and scientific, as well as technical and professional, on national lines and exclusively under national control, not in opposition to, but standing apart from the existing system of primary, secondary and collegiate education, attaching special importance to a knowledge of the country, its literature, history and philosophy, and designed to incorporate the best oriental ideals of life and thought, the best assimilable ideals of the West, and inspire students with the genuine love for and desire to serve the country. The foundation of the National Council of Education Bengal was made possible by the munificence of three generous donors, Raja Subodh Chandra Bosu Mallik, Brajendra Kishore Roy Choudhury of Gauripur, and Maharaja Suryakanta Acharya Choudhury Bahadur of Mymensingh. The first president of the National Council of Education was Sir Rashbihari Ghosh, and in its early days, nearly all notable figures of the time were associated with it, some of whom, such as Rabindranath Tagore and Aurobindo Ghosh, later won international recognition. In 1906, the year of the foundation of the National Council of Education Bengal, another association was set up known as the Society for the Promotion of Technical Education in Bengal, also under the presidency of Sir Rashbihari Ghosh, with the aim of imparting scientific and technical education to the people of India to further industrial progress. Under the auspices of this society, the Bengal Technical Institution, later known as the College of Engineering and Technology, Bengal, was started, financed mainly by Sir Taruknath Palit. In 1910, the Society for the Promotion of Technical Education in Bengal was amalgamated with the National Council of Education, Bengal. The National Council of Education Bengal started with its courses in arts, science and technology courses, but finding the public demand for the latter more insistent, the council came to devote almost all its resources to technical education through its College of Engineering and Technology. In 1921, the council had the good fortune to receive a donation of about 13 lakhs of rupees under the will of Sir Rashbihari Ghosh. This bequest enabled the council in 1924 to construct a number of buildings and workshops on its present site at Jadavpur. Besides the donations and endowments of the founders mentioned above, the council also received a sum of about 10 lakhs of rupees as donations from various other persons. The present site itself is a gift of the Corporation of Calcutta, which leased out 64 acres of land to the council at a nominal rent. At the time of independence in 1947, the College of Engineering and Technology, Bengal, was virtually functioning as a university. In view of this fact, and in order that the degree of the National Council of Education, Bengal, might receive statutory recognition, the Government of West Bengal, with the concurrence of the Government of India, enacted the necessary legislation for the establishment of a university at Jadavpur under the name of Jadavpur University, which started life on 24 December 1955. A new Jadavpur University Act was passed in 1981. It aimed to reconstitute the Jadavpur University to enable it to function more efficiently as a university, encouraging and providing for instruction, teaching, training, and research in various branches of learning and courses of study, promoting advancement and dissemination of knowledge and learning, and extending higher education to meet the growing needs of society and to make the constitution of various authorities or bodies of the university more democratic, consistent with the objectives of the National Council of Bengal and the Dawn Society. Now, the Department of Sociology, which officially came into being in December 2001, had its primeval origins in the teaching of general sociology as a component of the humanities course for students in the Faculty of Engineering and Technology from the year 1992 to 1993. The department started offering a two-year MPhil program in sociology, the first of its kind in West Bengal, from July 2002. The department launched since July 2006 a master's program in sociology. At present, the department thus offers a challenging and rigorous program as well as substantive research training leading to the MA, MPhil and the PhD degree programs. Now, sociology of religion was introduced in the MA program from the year 2009-2010 session, the first of its kind in India. Besides basic conceptions of sociology of religion, we have emphasized Durkheim, Max Weber, Habermas, Bourdieu, Foucault, Randall Collins' theoretical ideas, as well as we have introduced religion and gender, religious liberalism, fundamentalism, globalization and religious diversity, and the changing role of religion. We have planned to establish one center for the study of religion and society in the Department of Sociology, Jadavpur University, and preliminary works have already been completed. Our objectives of the proposed center for the study of religion and society is the first step to initiate a nuanced study of the realities of the modern world, in which religion is becoming an ever more important feature, just as it has been in previous generations, albeit today in quite a different shape. It will also promote a study of various aspects of religion in relation to society within the central motive of encouraging scholars to explore deeper and thus unveiling its more tolerant and universalizing features, resisting the spiral of societal hatred between groups of various religious orientations and hatred against diversity. The center wishes to promote respect and cooperation to increased knowledge of unity in diversity and universal values. The center is committed to do whatever is needed and according to its best capacity in order to undertake programs that will stimulate and encourage such perspectives. An important feature of Sociology of Religion program is that we encourage extensive research in collaboration with other universities, national or international. In this regard, the Swedish Research Council has approved the joint research project on religious studies and the secular state in collaboration with Gothenburg University, Sweden. In fact, the kickoff conference is going on from 6th to 10th June of this month, of this year. We also encourage student exchange programs time to time on any aspects of religious studies. We have signed agreement between two universities, that is Jadavpur University and Gothenburg University, for further research program and student or teacher exchange programs, especially on sociology of religion or religious studies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Professor Ruby Stein would have been a key figure at that conference, except that she would have to fly back to New Delhi in order to get her visa for a 4 or 5 day visit to Sweden. The local Swedish consul was unable or unwilling, despite efforts from this end and from Sweden, to issue her a visa from here. So their loss is our gain. Very glad you have you with us. I would like to do a bit of just some closing summary things, in which I introduce the devil's advocate at the very end, and leave that for another day or another year, if I may, and then open up to whatever we've got. It's okay. You're in charge. He did turn up. I thought that you were some great distant disaster, but I'm delighted that you're just a little late getting here, Professor Gavin Flood. Okay. So let's wrap up this presentation by reiterating the striking disparity between richness of human religious experience in South Asia and the scarcity of institutional basis for academic study of religion in all but a handful of South Asian universities. Factors contributing to the disparity are multiple: British colonial precedent, Western origin of religious studies, disparity in cultural and mentalities and languages, novelty and lack of resources, above all, perhaps severe tension between secularist and religio-political communalists. I chose to focus primarily on the last factor while commenting that an early predominance of secularist influence in independent India and a rapidly established Islamic predominance in West Pakistan severely inhibited the introduction and development of religious studies in both those countries, more drastically in the latter, in Pakistan. In East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, however, neither secularist nor Islamist interest and mentalities have as yet gained overwhelming predominance, given the rough balance between the two orientations and the relatively tolerant and non-ideological character of the bulk of the population. There is in Bangladesh both scope and warrant for introducing world religions, scholarship, and interfaith intercultural dialogue as mutually reinforcing means to mitigate what secularist Islamist tensions do exist there. The Bangladeshi experience may suggest that in religiously plural but still Hindu-majority India, where secularist and Hindu communalist interests are now more evenly balanced than before, there may be increasing scope and warrant for developing academic study of religion there for reasons analogous to those in Muslim-majority Bangladesh. How such study of religion optimally might be developed in different sectors of South Asia, and how risks of its capture and exploitation by politically powerful communalist interests, typically Hindu in India, Islamic in Pakistan and Bangladesh, Buddhist in Sri Lanka, are serious questions calling for careful attention before foreign academic fools rush in where South Asians fear to tread. And now the devil's advocate. Should academic study of religion be developed at all in South Asian universities? The array of factors inhibiting the emergence of academic study of religion in South Asian universities till now leaves us with a pair of rather daunting questions. How can it be done, if at all? And if so, should it be? Both questions merit more serious consideration than we have scope for here today, But as a goad to dealing with them seriously in the future, let me close with the following dismal chorus of hypothetical objections to developing an academic study of religion in South Asian universities. Number one, it would require more effort and resources than are going to be available. Number two, other disciplines are better equipped for research and teaching about religion. Number three, it could well be exploited by dominant religio-political communalist interests. Number four, related to that, it might lead to intercommunal conflict. Number five, it could upset the faith of students and disturb their parents. It's a serious issue. Number six, it is a Western enterprise that has no relevance in India. Number seven, foreign support and collaboration might well be subversive of Indian values. Number eight, we have whole conferences on this one. There's no such thing as religion anyway, at least not in India. Needless to say, I do not endorse this doomsday litany, but each of the objections does raise an issue that should be addressed by those who would, in a responsible way, strive to introduce or augment the academic study of religion in South Asian universities. Okay, so thank you for your patience in letting me have that. And we've stopped before the hour is up, and I'm sure many of you are eager to find out what Ruby has been doing at Jadavpur, and the floor is open. Do you want to take over at this point?
No, I think you should share.
Okay, so, yes, the first hand came up before the the conclusion, so you get first crack. Okay. Fire away.
I just wanted to add to your information.
Thank you.
That in 1942...
Yeah.
Sir Ashutosh Mukhopadhyay,
yes,
who was instrumental in introducing the Islamic History Department, where philosophy, history, religion, and culture was taught.
In Islamic history, introduced Ashutosh Mukherjee,
yes,
a Brahmin, introducing,
yes,
Islamic history.
Yes, that department was established. My father was brought into chair,
yes,
that.
Yes.
And Ketoki knows about this department.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah,
department is still very strong.
Yes.
At that point, from 1942 on, as far as I remember, only Aligarh Muslim University, mm-hmm, and Osmania University had Islamic history and culture and philosophy department.
Mm-hmm.
And in Calcutta, it's still quite strong, where they still teach Quran, Arabic, Urdu. My father translated the Gita into Arabic.
Fine.
It's the only one in the whole world. Right. And so that was encouraged. And that is still there.
Okay.
I don't know whether you are aware of that.
I know the department is there. I don't know of it in the depth that you just indicated. Particularly, I had no idea that your father was translating the Gita into Arabic, I
yes,
can assure you.
And he was invited to teach in Al-Azhar at Al-Azhar Cairo and Tehran and Kabul. Mm. He died very young, so, you know,
So not only do we have Ramohan Roy, we have your father, among the pioneers of language-based serious study of other religious traditions.
Yes. And he was also a Sanskritist, had a degree from Benares, mm-hmm, Shastri in Sanskrit.
Excellent.
And I was trained.
Very good, very good. To what extent does that department, you have this interesting approach to history in some of the Indian universities, you have ancient history, which is largely,
yeah,
Hindu Brahmin-oriented ancient history. Medieval history tends to be put into Islamic history, and then modern history tends to be a separate department as well. Ancient Indian history, Islamic history, and modern history. There's a kind of segmenting that goes on. Within the Islamic history department, to what extent would it be rigorously critical academic study? How much would it be confessional study? If you were at Aligarh and you were doing Islamic studies, it's probably done from a more confessional basis.
I don't think it was done that way.
You don't think so?
A secular approach.
You think it was in the Dhaka University in any event? Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was in Calcutta. But I have left Calcutta for a long time, so I can't tell what is going on now.
When I go back again, I will find out what is going on now.
And they do a lot of Islamic art as well.
Yes.
Ratnamali Chatterjee is one of them, you know.
Dhaka University has a funny way of separating things out. We have Islamic studies here. We have Arabic and Persian here. We have Islamic history and culture over here. And the more secular and types find their way to Islamic history and culture, the more orthodox types find themselves into Islamic studies.
I'll try to find more what's happening now.
Please do. Yes, indeed. Yes.
A few things which, as you know, I'm very excited by all of this area because I was in Lancaster in 1967 when Ninian Smart developed here.
Ah, he was a key figure in the study of religion.
And
certainly.
Also visited India and hoped that he might be of influence there as he was in other parts of the world.
And certainly influential in North America, and he spent time in North America toward the end.
That's where he was before he finally retired. He came back as a retired person. But some interesting things that you may not have implied as strongly as I might have heard, and that is that for me, you don't have to do, and indeed probably I would say it's better not to set out to do comparative work when you're studying religions. Themes that you want to work on comparatively may arise, but it seems to me there's more integrity to actually try to understand a religion in its own terms, as a phenomenologist, which is what I call myself, before you embark on anything comparative. So I'm always worried if the comparative religion is too upfront in describing the interdisciplinary field of the study of religions. Another thing is the framework of interfaith dialogue that's so much part of the vision as things have been set up in Dhaka, which seems to me to give it a very theological basis, which I think makes me uneasy in the tradition I would want to identify with in the academic study of religions. You know, you've made certain assumptions about this, and maybe that also links with your point, and I know, you know, that you're quoting others' objections, that studying in this way can actually be challenging to the faith of the people that are undergraduates and graduate students. But actually, that's always been something that's raised in relationship to people studying their own traditions as well. So it's certainly not unique to the academic study of religions in a plural way, or using the many disciplines that we do in the academic study of religions. You know, if somebody goes to Aligarh, a Muslim goes to Aligarh to study Islam, they will be challenged. I mean, it's always been said of sort of theology degrees when they've been Christian theology degrees too, and I'm sure that's true across the board. So that seems rather simplistic if people are assuming that that's going to be the case with the study of a variety of religions, and not if you study your own religion to any depth in an academic way. But that's not part of the to-ing and fro-ing of that debate in your experience.
Let me go to the first one if I can. I certainly agree with you. There's no point trying to compare things that you don't understand. But keep in mind that comparative religion was one of many titles. This field that is still changing itself. Yes. I think I threw out a longish parenthetical thing about how, while there might be different types of indigenized South Asian approach to religious studies, the Western tradition itself is continually changing. What I'd like to come back to is that in principle, for academic study of religion, the way that one would study one religious tradition at a general level should be similar to how you do the other. That if you're going to look at textual materials in your own religious tradition, you should be prepared to do some of the same things that you would do in another.
And, if I can respond
without
to that,
actually comparing the two, but to do it in a way that is not uniquely defined by the tradition and the faith assumptions of your tradition.
But it takes the depth of study, let's say, of Islam in itself, and the depth of study of Christianity in itself, to know that the Bible and the Quran are not comparable, because as situated within their own theological traditions, they actually have a very different source, use, one could go on and on and on. So very often when people might set out to do what they call comparative religion, they very simplistically, you know, make those sorts of assumptions, oh, we get to look at the Bible and the Quran. Whereas actually, if you set out to study particular traditions in their integrity, you may be studying more than one at the same time, but not setting out to make comparisons before you actually know how elements within a tradition are situated within that tradition, and therefore to realise that Bible and Quran are not actually comparable as types of text.
They're not comparable if you assume a high degree of similarity. If you take an interesting study like Wilfred Smith's last book, What is Scripture? What you find is a very sensitive awareness of how very differently texts that are seen as profoundly religious and mediums for expressing of faith in different traditions, how different they are. And Smith goes through it, how the ordinary sense of what Scripture was once was Bible. Now we know there are other Bibles. Now we know the other Bibles aren't like the Bible at all. The University of Dhaka, first of all, doesn't call itself comparative religion. It calls itself world religions. Mm-hmm. And what they have there is really a smorgasbord of study one, study of Islam, study of Christianity, study of cow dye, study of Baha'i, you have all of these. There's really very very little of comparative work done on it. But I think the coming to your second point, what do you do with a youngster who comes out of a tradition who says that the Quran is the final word of God, and that there is a personal God behind this, and then you study the Buddhists, and the Buddhists typically don't seem to affirm that there is a personal deity there. It's a bit of a challenge. You look at tribal religion, and if you try to look at tribal religion in its own context, you find that a plurality of divine beings are there. This results certainly in a growth of religious awareness. But I think it can be somewhat challenging. You come out of a tradition where the parents have had you doing certain rituals all the time, and then you discover that there are Muslims around the world that don't do those things. There can be a...
But your illustrations, for instance, already stretch the category of world religions, because you've talked about tribal religions, what I think some colleagues would prefer to talk about as indigenous traditions, which, for example, don't have scriptures. They're orally based originally.
We're out of the scripture realm at this point.
But then don't count as world religions either. I mean, that's a very contested term. I mean, I know you know all of these things I'm saying, but I just think, you know, they're kind of worth airing in the context of some of the ideas you've brought to our attention. So I'm certainly not challenging you personally, because I know you're very established as part of all this discussion. But in terms of, you know, what you've mapped out as the issues within this particular context.
It was interesting that they gave up on one title of the thing, comparative religion, for certain reasons. World religions is there. World religions, interestingly, got Wilfred Smith, of all people, into difficulty at Harvard because he was slow to encourage the development of study of indigenous religion in Africa, in that it had not had a worldwide spread. There wasn't a learned tradition and, a shareable scriptural tradition. He said this is how the thing was set up, but he was eventually persuaded that that's an unfortunately limiting terminology. You have to call it something. Interestingly enough, we've had this change in the name of the Dhaka program from comparative religion to world religion to now world religions in the plural and culture.
Right.
And who knows what it will be two or three years from now. But we should perhaps have some focus on Jodhpur, where exciting things are happening. Yes, sir, Gopal.
I was going to say that in India, probably I have some idea, there's been this interesting development of institutions for religious studies outside the university system. I mean, we have in Delhi, about which I know, a Christian institution, Vidya Jyoti. It's a fine institution. And we have Institute of Islamic Studies Then in the University of Delhi, in the department, there is a department of Buddhist studies. And these are all dedicated to pursuing, as you say, studies of individual religions and their traditions and so on. I think in many universities, departments of Sanskrit, which are language departments, but also do religious texts, for example. And this doesn't receive state patronage, although the Buddhist department in Delhi University is part of the regular university. Private resources seem to go in setting up such institutes, and the only earlier effort to pursue religious studies was focused on Islam, as has been pointed out, in Calcutta or in Dhaka or in Aligarh or in Usmania. We had in Delhi thing financed by the Nizam of Hyderabad, and so on. So the kind of thing you are proposing may be difficult, but there are other ways of getting around these difficulties and set up these specialist institutions who would do language, literature, texts, even comparative religion to an extent.
The Dhaka University's own Department of Islamic Studies, interestingly, some years before this new department appeared, did have one stream within it, or one paper or set of papers, in which you looked at several religious traditions.
Yes.
What I was told is that the key person who developed that did it with a quite disciplined, fair-minded approach to treat the other traditions as they would express themselves. He has since gone, and the tendency, what I'm told, is that you now tend to take an Islamic understanding of it, which is a legitimate thing in a way, a theological assessment from your point of view of where these others fit into the divine plan. But it sort of shifted in that direction. So now they felt that they needed this other one, where the other traditions were looked on in their own terms. Nizam of Hyderabad, by the way, put up the money for a Nizam chair at Vishwabharati during Tagore's lifetime. You had that sort of arrangement. When Tagore would be there, you've got this central figure who can sort of pull together the human resources, the people, the ideas of the different sectors. Without that kind of central focus, there's a tendency for the departments to fall back into themselves. If they are dominated by strong scholars who have rigorous standards, then they maintain it. If they're not so strong in the second generation, and oftentimes a new program has very powerful people at the beginning, very high. The whole Vishwabharati situation is suffering from what do you do after Tagore. In a certain sense, the department or program in the study of religion has a kind of a catalytic role and a kind of midwifing role of trying to bring together the scholars in the several departments. For instance, at Dhaka, again, we have a Sanskrit professor who does the course on things Hindu. We have good people in sociology working with us. We've got people, I think, from Islamic history. The role of the religious, and at Toronto again, we have at least as many people appointed to our graduate center as we have in our own department, trying to, if you will, maximize the religious studies potential of the more segmented departments, in which the religious sensitivity can either go into a more confessional mode, or it's apt to get marginalized, and you start doing historical textual stuff that doesn't really get at what people mean by the text when they're using them. But thank you very much for that briefing. I know some of the Catholic colleges along the way would have, in some cases, very strong Christian studies.
Yes.
I know one of my colleagues at Toronto from one of the sister colleges. No, he's from our college. He was in the theology section of our college. Had been at Bangalore at a center for Christian theological studies. He was a Hebrew and other Old Testament related language expert. He liked it so much, he was given an invitation to go there, and he gave up his tenured position at St. Michael's College in Toronto in order to have what would have been an ongoing position there until there was a change of government and they decided there was a flaw in his visa and they threw him out in 3 days. But you have that. Also, people tell me that in some of the Jesuit colleges, for instance, they might actually have a quite carefully done teaching about Hindus, Muslims, and others, since most of their students are Hindus, Muslims, and others than the Christian. But you're quite right; they're not in the main university system. And if you're not if you are a minority group, you are allowed much more scope to do things your way, to do them well, or to do them badly, or to do them idiosyncratically. So much so that the Vedanta Society, the Ramakrishna people, for some years were trying to be distinguished from Hindus. Now, we'd always thought of them as a kind of the Irenic pulling together in a modern way of a more Vedantan look at the whole family of things Hindu. They wanted to get out from under the government strictures, and I don't think they were allowed to do it. I think the government decided they were Hindus whether they wanted to be or not.
Something like this Catholic Jesuit institution with Vidyajyoti, they have specialists in Hinduism, Islam,
that's right,
Christianity. Yeah. They, as far as I know, they don't do comparisons, but they pursue their own deeper studies of Christian tradition or Hindu tradition. Islamic tradition.
Comparative religion is a term that isn't used all that much nowadays.
No,
Harvard University, oddly enough, has a whole set of options you can take within what they call the PhD in religion. They then have the Christian theology thing.
Yeah.
One of those fields is, in fact, called, but it's only, I think it's field I. You have to go all the way down to I before you get into comparative study of the major world religions. That's where I found myself, but in fact, leave aside things like sociology, which are discipline-related tool fields for us. The bulk of my work was Hindu and Indian. The Sanskrit I did, the Indian. So there wasn't, and even my own thesis, it wasn't a comparison, but it was, in fact, an awareness of the Vaishnava tradition in Bengal in relation to a Muslim regime that allowed it considerable scope to move around, or there were frictions at certain points, and then how that tradition related in a tactful way, if you will, with the Muslims around it. My next project, however, took me to Bangladesh, where I began reading on Bengali Muslim literature and trying to balance it off.
Well, sociology of religion can get around many of these problems.
It's a very, very useful, very helpful tool. My favorite subject in grad school.
You can do all kinds of things. Theological studies didn't attend to.
Older theological studies didn't. Newer theological studies,
utilizes
that a lot.
For sociology of religion is lived religion. Mm. What do people do in terms of having a religious life, which is somewhat different and in many ways more interesting than, let us say, textual studies. When I did a national study of Muslims, mm-hmm. I found sociological approach the most interesting mm-hmm. To try and understand what Islam means.
But you do need the
and
text.
What Islam, what Islam
without
means,
the text, how do you get there?
What people do as Muslims, and so on. So all I'm trying to suggest to you is that a lot of things are going on in this field, and now that the religious factor has emerged as socially important, mm-hmm. I mean, for a long time it was quiescent, but now, thanks to Al-Qaeda and Islamic militancy and so on, concern with religion has become more urgent, that Indian universities would start taking this up, and there would be a more favorable response to people who wish to pursue religious studies.
Sociology has the great advantage, I think, that political science doesn't have, in that it doesn't focus you on the competition, the potential for violence. Politics is sort of warfare in a different kind of way. Sociological study can address factors that get you into severe conflict, but it also can address the whole range of other sectors of well, life that makes it so suitable
for
the study.
To say that theology is not important. Theology is extremely important, yes, because it is part of intellectual development of the religious idea in particular cultures. So, I mean, far be it from me to downgrade.
It would be nice if there were more contemporary theology that took, yes, sociology and, yes, immediate history. And there are, of course, people doing that sort of thing. But Professor Ruby Sain's situation is very strategically placed. It is the sociology department in a good, very good university where your students typically are quite capable of handling English language materials, though I do wish that we were not so dependent on English language materials. For years there was there were publications on a journal for towards an Indian sociology, but I don't know how Indian it ever got.
Could I ask Ruby whether, yes, there's an Indian Association for the Study of Religions, which has joined the International Association for the History of Religions? You know, most of the countries where there is the study of religions have got a national association. Does India have one yet? Because obviously with all this happening, one would imagine that might have been convened by the scholars in India working in this field.
I don't think we have one.
There is an association of some sort. I don't know whether it is directly linked with the International Association of History of Religions. When Asha Mukherjee convened the conference of the workshop a couple of years back, she in fact sent the note out to everybody on the mailing list. Now, she was not the convener of that association, whatever it was. Very few of them turned up, and the association had been relatively dormant. I don't think the person in charge had taken any initiative, so she just sent out an invitation and said, come join us, and a few did. I think what may be the case that there is a kind of a South and Southeast Asian entity that would speak for them all, but of the people on that list, most of them seem not to be very energetically involved in academic study of religion.
And the other thing I just want to check with you, why Sweden? Why is this, there is a very strong link with Sweden rather than Denmark or UK or Germany or any other place where there's strong...
Actually, Ferdinando Sorella was my student a few years back, and now he's professor of one Swedish university. And it was between Ferdinando Sordella and me that we established this relationship. And then we thought that we'll develop this study. And that's why it is only for Ferdinando Sordella that I was interested to introduce sociology of religion in my department.
That's why
I have a strong relation with Swedish University.
Personal relation.
From personal to institutional.
Yes.
There's another person, a Swede, and that's Ake Sanda, who for a number of years has been associated with the Banaras Hindu University. And he was the teacher of Ferdinando back in Sweden. So they have built on their relationship with Banaras and have broadened that into a funded project that's been going on for a couple of years involving Jodhpur, Banaras Hindu, Patiala, not Vishwabharati, though I think they're being brought into a newer one that they're in the midst of funding.
So it would be
now.
A very natural link. It's not sociology, it's philosophy of religion, with somebody like Chakravarti Ramprasad, who's at Lancaster.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's
Indian. Mm. And back and forth regularly, but yes. you know him.
So yes, I know him.
I mean, he's a philosopher of religion. Mm-hmm. But, yes. I mean, obviously, this is an interdisciplinary field, so that wouldn't be excluded, but that would make a very good...
In our departments, when we studied Sanskrit, we are never encouraged to look at Hinduism as such. Mm-hmm. We were taught the texts. Mm-hmm. You read the Vedas, and I took special papers in Smriti and Mimamsa. You read Vedanta and all these things. Then, if you want to know it further, go to the Pandits in the Tolls in Sanskrit College and go further. But never... we were never taught to look at Hinduism as such in that way. We were trained to look at the text. First, look at the text, then think about these things when you go farther beyond masters.
Sociology, if there was, would be study of Manu, I suppose. What Manu thinks it ought to be, not necessarily how Manu was ever practiced.
With Manu, we had to read other Smriti texts as well, not just solely Manu, so we could really compare and see for ourselves.
But they would be other Dhammashastra texts, I suppose. Yeah. They wouldn't be... sociological studies. Yeah,
Kautilya was there.
There is a website for the Forum for the Study of Society and Religion that is a Swedish entity, and I've got some of the material that I've printed down off from this, thanks to Ferdinando Sardella. Just how they got started on this thing 5 or 10 years ago out of Banaras Hindu is not clear to me. But I think they were finding that working with Professor Rupi Sen at Jodhpur in the short time they were doing it was working more smoothly than at Banaras Hindu.
Yeah.
Perhaps because...
there's a really good personal rapport there, and that does help.
Well, there are the problems that there are competing interests at Jodhpur that are trying to get things out from under Professor Ruby Sen, but they've been beaten back. So, I just mentioned in sociology the people that have been most helpful to our little department of world religions and culture are colleagues in the sociology department. And they've even, through their efforts, we have one issue of the Bangladesh E-Journal of Sociology that's exclusively papers from seminars that we put together in our department on religion in Bengal. One of the things I try to get them to do is focus their attention on religion in Bengal, in part for national self-awareness, but also because you can more reasonably do some new research with minimal funding, knowing the languages, if you will do some of this on local subjects. And the sociology people have been very supportive of us in that regard.
You're talking about Dhaka.
Back to Dhaka again, yeah.
But in earlier I don't know what the current situation is. The Anthropological Survey of India, which was based in Calcutta, did lots of monographs on religion. Religions of different groups of people.
Nirmal Kumar Bose would have a sensitivity for these things, and Surajit Sinha again on Vaishnavism in Bhumi.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Now, if some of us are going up to Wolfson,
does Judith know whether it's happening?
Okay. She was going to find out.
Yes, shall I?
Could you come
check
back,
her?
One if by land, two if by sea, and I and the other bank will be, or something like this. Paul Revere's right. thank you, Ruby, for preparing this on short notice, and thank you for biting the big bullet to launching something on a small department in a university where standards are high, you've got to produce.
What's happening in Toronto? Do you have
a we have a department for the study of religion, and it's quite a strong department. And it's now very broadly based. We've probably got 15 or 20 people in the department, some of whom are shared with another department. And then we have at the graduate level about as many scholars cross-appointed to give the odd course, to supervise research. When I took early retirement at a time when things were not looking so good, the South Asian area had been allowed across disciplines to deteriorate and disappear through refusal to rehire people. It was very frustrating. The Department for the Study of Religion was losing through retirement a number of people, mostly those who also had a Christian specialization. But shortly after I took early retirement, the funding situation changed. And in our department particularly, we've gotten six or eight really quite good young people. We've got, I think, three doing Hindu-related things. I think a couple of them shared doing Islamic things, a couple of good people doing things Buddhist. The Christian tradition is struggling to maintain itself well in the
Buddhist study is doing well everywhere, I think.
The Buddhist tradition seems to be doing well. A lot of the scholars, the foreign scholars doing things Buddhist, have in fact converted in. What's happening to our confessional academic thing is taking a bit of a slip. But of course, we've always said that one's personal faith is one thing. The disciplined kind of research and writing that you do, and the genuine listening to other people so that you can sensitively, if not speak for them, at least convey a sense of how they speak when they speak.